Dr. Sharp, were you involved with the U.S. civil rights movement as well?
Very little, because I lived in Europe for 10 years, in England and Norway, from 1955 to 1965. I had done, before 19, way back in... '49 or '50, and we did do a lunch. I was sitting in Columbus, Ohio, and we had a small group that was preparing itself for that kind of activity. But what the biggest cases you are familiar with, I wasn't here.
Right. Yeah. But I read that you were involved with the movement. Were there places that you were involved that you?
Only what I mentioned in Columbus, Ohio.
In Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
And at what point did you meet Albert Einstein?
I never met him.
Oh.
That would have been in 1953, when I had been arrested and I was to be sentenced shortly and sent to jail. I wrote him. He had been, at the end of his life, very interested in Gandhi.
Right.
And it's particularly in the context of U.S. civil liberties. And it was the McCarthy period and major civil liberties problems in those days. So he became very interested in Gandhi, saying, for example, that, and these are not his words, but he was the most important political thinker of our time. No qualifications, you know. And I had just done this book. I was 25.
What book had you done?
A book. I can show you a copy. It was only published in India. It's called Gandhi Wields the Weapon of Moral Power, Three Case Histories. And I had done research in the New York Public Library and from Gandhi's own writings published in India for that. And so I asked, I had completed this book, and that was after my MA at Ohio State University. And so I said, I'm about to go to jail, but in the meantime, I've done this book on Gandhi that you've been talking about. And would you consider writing a foreword to it? And to my surprise, he both supported me in my civil disobedience to conscription and agreed. He said he would if he agreed with most of it. And so he did.
I'll have to look for the foreword, yeah. He was at Princeton at that time?
He was living in Princeton on Mercer Street.
So
he was very kind.
Now, Einstein was a socialist. Are you a socialist?
Not really. I'm unidentified. You know, the political labels don't work for me, either to choose something to believe in or to identify myself. The first chapter of one of my books, I think it's Social Power and Political Freedom, is titled Rethinking Politics. The old slogans, the old programs don't speak to the conditions of our time, is the gist of that. But we can think through and come up with something better.
Well, in the sense of the market economy, the global market economy, and the great inequality in the world, what do you advocate as a solution?
I have not written on economics.
Okay.
I don't know much about economics.
So, during the Chile coup in 1973, September, were you involved in the movement against the U.S. involvement against the coup?
Not really.
No? Where were you living?
My writings, however, were used in Chile. A small... You said you spoke Spanish?
Yes.
La lucha política no violenta.
Okay. Okay.
Extreme condensation of my three volumes, which are the politics of nonviolent action. They had an extreme condensation with that same title had been done in Mexico. And
then when was this published? This was published in the 80s?
I'm no good at dates.
Okay. It's all right.
It might be on my bio notes, but okay. I doubt it. It's in my publications
Maybe
list.
I can get a copy. Is that on the internet?
Both of those are on the web. You can download them easily. And these translations are also often there in quite a number of languages.
So in Asia, as I recall, you were in Burma and in Tiananmen Square. You were in Burma. Yeah. Was that a wide circle that you cut, or was it just those two places? Or
I also later was in Taiwan.
You were in Taiwan. During the student uprising?
No. No, much later. Again, I can't give you the years.
Right.
But I was there. I was a lecturer.
Okay.
And there have been several of my books published in Taiwan. And more coming.
Oh, good.
In fact, there's one thing that you probably don't know about. It's called self-liberation. It's a guide to strategic planning for people who want to struggle to undermine the dictatorships or oppression. And that came out of the experiences of doing workshops in quite a number of places and not being satisfied with the results. Yeah. So that led me to think about, because I learned people do not learn much useful from lectures, from listening. It can arouse interest. It can give them some information. It can't prepare them for planning their own struggle. So what could do that? So we worked out this other plan with three major components. They have to understand their own situation in depth, including the weaknesses of the oppression. They have to understand nonviolent struggle in depth, and they never do. And they have to be able to think strategically. And maybe they can, but most likely they can't. They need to learn how to do that. So then, with Jamila's help, we put those ideas and understandings, which I had expressed in letters, long letters, to one Middle Eastern country, dissidents in one Middle Eastern country, together into this guide for strategic planning. It required them to read 900 pages in English. That's the condensed version of the readings. And then, if they're not interested in reading 900 pages, they're not interested in revolution or freedom. It's really my attitude, at least. And so we published that. Now that is on our website. And all the readings, they go on the computer, they can just punch and dot or whatever, and download all of that, no matter where they are.
Right.
If they got paper in their computer and so on. So that's been downloaded in these past 2 or 3 months, an incredible number of times, which is frightening in some ways. But also in Taiwan, they are translating all of that, including the 900 pages, into Mandarin.
Why do you say it's frightening in some ways?
Stunning is probably a better word.
Yes. No, the events happening now in the Arab world are stunning, as you say, but we still haven't seen the end of what's happening.
No. Libya is not finished. They've appeared to have made some major errors. Things may be important. I don't know how that started exactly. But it was not in strict imitation of the Egyptians.
Right. Well, and Gaddafi had said he would not leave.
But that's not a problem for the way you might think. That's not an insurmountable problem. It's a difficulty. But you have to learn then how to take the sources of power away from him. I identify, I think, 6 major sources of power in the first chapter of The Politics of Nonviolent Action.
Okay, and this one, yes.
Yes. Yeah, but it's in there in a very condensed version.
Right.
But if you get those sources of power all depend for their availability on the cooperation and obedience and submission of many people and groups and institutions. That assistance is never perfect. It varies. Sometimes almost fully available, sometimes very little available, to the degree that you restrict the obedience and cooperation. You're restricting the availability of that source of power. And when that extends over even to sanctions, punishments, meaning the police and the troops, if they no longer obey,
that's right,
then the regime's power is gone. It's gone. And nobody's left to surrender. They're not waiting for him to resign. I find that a strange concept. You have to cut it off and deal with it. Let me take a quick break to the John out here.
Okay.
I'll be right back. And it's very interesting.
Thank you.
It's the only guide in English to the power to block and defeat coup d'etat.
I saw you mention this, yes.
It's very important.
He just left Wentworth and moved to Benjamin Franklin Institute.
That's what I heard. Yeah.
You know him?
He's the father of my best friend, my very dear friend.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
How long have you been in Boston?
So I went to Simmons College,
okay.
And I graduated in 2001.
Okay.
So it's been a number of years, about 13 years, 12 years.
So did you have Professor David Gillette? No?
Right. I definitely know the name, but I don't believe I ever had him as a professor.
How about Becky Thompson?
Again, sounds very familiar.
Okay.
What department is that? Is that history?
David is in English. Becky was in sociology.
Oh, I see.
Teresa Perry is there.
Okay, see, I took mainly management courses.
Okay.
And you international were in the relations and political science.
Okay.
Yeah, so yeah. I was in somewhat of a different department.
Do you have family in Afghanistan still?
I do. My mother is actually there now.
Mother is?
Yeah, she's there just visiting for a few weeks. So she's between Peshawar and Jalalabad. And my whole extended family is there.
Yeah.
In Jalalabad and Kabul. But my immediate family, my sisters and my parents are here in the U.S. Hi, can get in. Good morning, Einstein Institution. Hi, Bruce. How are you doing? Great. Oh, yes. It's really been very, very hectic. Basically nonstop media and, inquiries and requests and book orders and issues with our website. Can't handle all the traffic. So we've had to sort of upgrade several times. It's been really incredible, really incredible. I know that Jean, yes, it's great. Thank you so much, Jean. It's Bruce. What would you like to? Would you like to take?
I'm calling back.
Okay. Would it be okay if we actually have somebody in the office right now? Would it be possible to give you a call back? Okay. So when might be good?
Is he home? Is his office home?
Oh, great. That should work perfectly fine before then. And where could he reach you? Are you at home or in your office? Or? Sure. Okay, great. Okay. Okay. Okay, great. Thank you so much, Bruce. I think Gene will give you a call back pretty soon, maybe the next hour or so. Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks again. Thank you. It really is. Yeah. There's quite a bit of interest in the anti-coup. I think Gene will want to tell you about it himself. So, I think you'll be interested to hear that.
Yeah.
It's getting some very high-level interest.
Okay.
Yes. But thank you for what you've just said. It's all very, very exciting. Right. Okay, thanks, Bruce. All right, bye. Okay, sorry, Gene, the phone rang while I was doing something with your schedule here. So he's there until about 1 o'clock. And I wrote his phone number down, so you can call him anytime.
Good.
Okay, this is yours.
All right.
Great. I
hope there's been no new appointments after today, right?
No, just okay. Still waiting to hear back from Grace.
Okay. So where were we?
I was asking you to sign this, but oops, careful.
It's okay. Just want to lose my balance.
Well, I wanted to talk with you a bit about Burma and the Philippines, and then talk with you about some of the folks that you work with. And I asked some of these questions because they're on the web, some because I have them. But, for instance, in the Philippines, the revolt that overthrew Marcos has been portrayed as exclusively nonviolent. And yet, there were at least half a dozen people killed. And at three critical junctures, the military that were rebelling against Marcos played major roles. On February 24th, helicopters attacked the palace, Malacanang Palace. They also took over one of the television stations, killing soldiers loyal to Marcos in the process. And the next day, they attacked another television station with arms and killed other Marcos loyalists. How do you square the fact that those actions have not been portrayed as part of the people power
upfront? I don't know. I don't know who was writing the histories.
Yeah. Stephen Zunis, for instance, has written histories of the Philippine struggle in which these actions by the military are not mentioned. And it just seems to me that, you know, no movement is ever purely violent, nonviolent. Uh-huh. It's not black and white. And I guess the question I'm asking is, what are the shades to you of all of this? In other words, is there a way in which the Philippine military rebels and the people power in the streets were able to help each other? It seems they were in this case. But how do you view that dynamic?
I think that there's always the probability that if violence is used in the midst of a nonviolent struggle movement, it's going to weaken the nonviolent struggle movement. Those particular cases I was not familiar with. So it's hard to analyze how they did or did not play a role.
Now, I met activists on the Burma-Thai border who...
Koreans?
No, Burmese, who were in the... let's say the armed rebel groups who were trying to overthrow the government. And they were bitterly complaining to me about Colonel Helvey. Is that how you say his name? They said specifically to me that they felt his... let me find it here. They said specifically, I wrote it down here, that his seminar, and your seminar as well, they mentioned, help to disarm and make the Burmese movement less powerful. Specifically, what they were saying was that Aung San Suu Kyi's father had united the many minority groups to create Burma. And because Aung San Suu Kyi had such a black-white position on armed struggle, the minorities who were defending themselves with guns in the jungles were not part of the NLD, the National League for Democracy.
Yes.
They were isolated from it by essentially a strict nonviolence. How do you respond to that?
There might have been people from the ABSDF, the Old Burma Student Democratic Federation.
And also from the minority army, the Karen, the other groups.
Well, the all of us from the ethnic groups, like the Koreans and the Kachins and so forth, we met with those groups, and not just once, but several times. They had been struggling with great bravery in extremely difficult circumstances, with great casualties. They were happy to explore nonviolent struggle, as were the Burmese and the ABSDF. But they maintained their full confidence in the violence.
Right.
Those people, violence is almost a religious principle. It's like the military version of a pacifist, except that its violence is the pure and necessary, absolutely necessary approach. And we do these other things at the time if it helps. But they never gave up their real confidence in military means. So they would view that as a gross misinterpretation of what happened, in my mind. Because, in a sense, they didn't know. They didn't fully understand. So I would not be surprised that that occurred. But it's not as clear as they're painting it. Aung San Suu Kyi, very heroic, very laudatory, and all that. But she was never a strategist. So in the NLD, we met with some of their people in Thailand in particular. And they didn't have a grand strategy how they're really going to get rid of the Sloak or any other military group of leaders. The so-called coalition government of the Union of Burma, which has, as a supposed coalition government, had their headquarters in Washington, D.C.? What the hell's going on? Whereas the Burmese, there was an easy contact with Burmese. It has been in Thailand. And they choose Washington, D.C. We invited them up, which when we had money in a big office. We invited them up. And they came, and we just presented this, and they discussed it, and they had the writings. They never understood or never chose to push it, because they had their own program as to how to achieve freedom for Burma. And it did not include this. So it doesn't surprise me that these things are said or heard or at times even believed, but it's by no means the whole picture.
Well, but is there a way for these, let's say, very strict pacifists and religious believers in violence, as you put it, to work together? You spoke together.
Why? Because the violence detracts and helps to undermine the nonviolent struggle. Violence works in a very different way than nonviolent struggle. And they are not compatible. It won't mean there'll be a classic textbook case in every instance, but then fundamentally they work in different ways. You can't have people who are using violent struggle then to say the nonviolent struggle as helping their struggle.
But then what would be your attitude to such people in Burma if you were...
We work with them and try to show them that not also has a greater chance of success than does the violence. And therefore, even if you believe in violence as the best, you can temporarily support this nonviolent struggle, or at least keep your violence out of it. If you're not going to help the nonviolent struggle, at least don't mess it up. But not by preaching at them, but by saying this other approach has greater chances of mobilizing the power of more people in more effective ways than does your violence, which automatically restricts the number of people using them also.
Now, Colonel Helvey, who I don't know, retired Colonel Helvey, went to, as I read, at least 8 other places with you.
That's possible. I don't remember.
So, a question, is your weapon of nonviolence, which is obviously very effective, but has it been co-opted by the U.S. government?
No. We have no support. You can see how much of support we have to the U.S. government.
Not you personally,
or
the institution.
Or Helvey. But I know Helvey very well.
I don't know him. I've never met him. But what I mean is, for instance, let me say from my personal point of view. In my book on 68, I discovered this phenomenon of how movements spread through intuition and identification. And I had to wonder, reading Samuel Huntington, did he read my book and learn from it and use my insights to stop such movements? So my question is, are people in the U.S. government using your tactical insights on the power of nonviolence to overthrow dictatorships to achieve U.S. policy goals?
Not to mind. I think I don't necessarily support all things Sam Huntington was putting forth, but I think he's not adequately understood. I was at the Center for International Affairs when he was the director, and he was responsible for my maintaining my connections and research and office in the Center for International Affairs. When an underling in the center, an administrator, was telling me, we don't have an office for you.
Who said that? After he was out, they said they have no office?
No, not quite. I didn't say that. He was the director. His decision went. As a lower administrator under, at that time, in the Center for National Affairs, told me, we have no office for you.
Oh, I see.
And that my appointment was to end. He insisted I should be allowed to have an appointment and have an office. He supported the continuation of my work.
I see. But this is this for what ends? I mean, Huntington is not a believer in nonviolence.
He's a believer in freedom and academic freedom.
Well, but still, I would question his support for you, because, for instance, he's such a in Vietnam, his policy of forced draft urbanization, to bomb the countrysides, drive people into the cities, to deny the enemy access to the population, to dry up the sea that the fish, the gorillas, swim in, resulted in hundreds of thousands of deaths. And
I know nothing of that. But it isn't a case of belief in nonviolent means. Most nonviolent struggle has not been based on people believed in it as a moral or religious principle. It's been used almost always, with rare exceptions, by people who believed in violence, but were using nonviolent struggle for practical reasons. What Sam was doing any time, I don't know.
Well, what about Helvey? I don't know him, but he was in the army. So I assume, having grown up in the Army, I met very few pacifists in the Army.
He's not a pacifist. He's not a pacifist. He never thinks...
Helvey is not a pacifist.
No. I don't... This... You've got to break this connection.
It's a pragmatic...
Yes. You've got to break this connection in your head of pacifism with nonviolent struggle. That's not a valid connection. he became an expert on nonviolent struggle. He never thought that what he had done in the Vietnam War was morally wrong. He said he did that. He doesn't deny it. But he knows that nonviolent struggle. We have a book by him, a small book by him, we can give you. Read what it says and how nonviolent struggle works and operates.
What did he do in Vietnam?
I don't know. He was an officer. Yeah. Okay, thank you much.
Thank you.
There's very important insights in that as to how nonviolent struggle works.
Okay, but I mean, here we have a man then who's advocating strategic nonviolent struggle.
Yeah.
But he's a retired colonel. Then
yeah.
I read that in the Freedom House, where your colleague, Peter Ackerman,
yeah.
Was former director, so was James Woolsey, the CIA director under Clinton from 93 to 95, and that Ackerman is on the board of the Spirit of America, along with General Mike DeLong, who supervises an $8.2 billion budget that includes issues in Iraq and in other wars that the U.S. is fighting.
I don't know anything about that.
But don't you feel, I mean, you are you a pacifist besides being a believer
I
in
was,
strategic?
I was. But you're saying...
Wouldn't you want to convince these people not for the U.S. government to use violence? Isn't that part of
you don't
your mission? I'm mistaken here.
Well, maybe you need to use different words or different concepts. You're thinking of a black and white approach. You have the good, pure pacifists, and you have the real pro-military people, and you have nothing in between. That's not reality. Gandhi was not a pacifist. He was not a supporter of military means either. He was what one of the writers about his work called war. He was a pioneer in the development of war without violence.
Okay.
You don't get rid of violence by preaching against it or by personally resisting it. I don't think my time in jail is a damn thing to get rid of the war system. It only maintained my sense of my own integrity. That was an achievement that was helpful to my continuing my future. But the overwhelming application of nonviolent struggle is for pragmatic reasons. It's often adopted by people who have used violence before themselves, or who have supported violence for such and such cause, or helped it. But they choose for the time of that struggle to use these other means because they have a greater chance of success. The three little Baltic nations, I was in the ceremony, the graveyards, the cemeteries in, I think it was Latvia. The cemetery goes way back. There are stone figures there of warriors in suits of armor and big swords. These were the people who conducted nonviolent guerrillas, correction. These were the people who conducted very courageous guerrilla struggle against both the Soviet occupation and the Nazi occupation. But without ever renouncing that, these people chose to use nonviolent struggle to get out of the Soviet Union and did so bravely with very, very few casualties. And they're good thinkers. The Latvians, I have here somewhere a book they have done, a huge book on the use of nonviolent struggle in Latvia for Latvian independence.
The Singing Revolution.
Yes, but that includes all three countries.
Right.
The linking of arms from Tallinn in the north way down to Vilnius for hundreds of miles. Purely symbolical. But the governments, with that history and with having these heroes, and the defense minister's office in Lithuania, they have a big picture of the guerrilla hero of those struggles. While we were meeting to discuss nonviolent struggle, they never denounced that, but they saw this other way. And then people don't adopt it as a Milton show. They adopt it little by little, or poco a poco, for how to achieve their independence, taking step by step, step by step. It wasn't Paul on the road to Damascus. It's suddenly brilliance. Total truth descends upon him, you know, supposedly.
Well, but in this way, then, it's a pragmatic adoption of a tactic in the arsenal of warfare.
But more than the tactic, it's actually a small-scale operation as a strategy, even the grand strategy, which is even bigger, of course.
Well, but with the Helvey and with Woolsey and with Mike DeLong, are you familiar? Have you met DeLong or Woolsey?
No, they're irrelevant. I don't know what they did.
I think they embrace this as a means to get rid of regimes that they don't want.
We have no information they embrace this. That's a pure myth. We would have heard from them if they had. We heard about them if they had. I think that's a myth. Somebody's connecting dots, which are empty.
Well, I don't know who they are exactly, but it's disturbing to me that the U.S. military has been involved with so many of the same boards. Isn't it to you? Doesn't it?
No. I mean, thank goodness, if that's all true, I assume that. That they also were letting this go through, that's progress. If you're going to limit the support and participation to the people who are true believers, who've never done anything wrong to be ashamed of, you're limiting it to a very small number of people.
My concern here is with the outcome. In other words, let's say, for instance, in the Philippines, Marcos was corrupt, he was ousted. When Aquino came to power, within a year, poor farmers who were nonviolently protested were shot down in the streets of Manila.
I can believe that.
Yeah.
So
the outcome of strategic nonviolent action, how can it be like you handed me this book on the anti-coup, but how can the continuation of the struggle for justice be seen in your view? If, for instance, Aquino becomes the new president, but it's still the rich landowning families who are going to then use violence to suppress farmers, what can we say about the longevity of the strategy of nonviolent?
But do you know the assumption you're making?
Explain.
The assumption is you have one nonviolent struggle, it solves everything forever. It doesn't. It only deals with one specific objective at that time. Then you need new plans, new strategies, maybe new organizations to make more inroads into the oppression. It's not one struggle that solves everything all at once.
Right.
No. So you have to then outline how this can be used to change the landowner system, to bring down other types of socioeconomic or political oppression.
And you had said earlier that you're more oriented to the political aspect of dictatorships, not to economics.
Yes, I'm sympathetic with the economic changes, of course. But I just haven't done that. I haven't had an economic course since I was an undergraduate many years ago.
Okay. I mean, another disturbing feature of the Philippines is that Fidel Ramos, who became the president after Aquino, worked with the Bush family and the Carlyle Group, making huge investment monies, you know, making huge profits out of his investment monies. And if these nonviolent struggles are simply opening doors for people to become wealthy. Doesn't it worry you that you're being, you know, used by people?
How Ramos abused us? Or used me?
Ramos, for instance, uses the money to become president. He never would have become president if Marcos had been in power.
Yeah.
And so through nonviolently replacing Marcos with Aquino and then Ramos, Ramos is able to benefit from it in economic terms.
But you're assuming that the struggle to solve all of these problems, change all the motivations of anybody within 5 years. It doesn't. It doesn't. It's not. I'm trying to think. The people aren't